For private and government-sponsored donations, Americans gave almost $300 billion in international aid in 2011. Where's that money going and who is it helping? Well, Tori Hogan tries to answer those questions and explain how she thinks international aid can be made more efficient and more effective in her new book called Beyond Good Intentions. It chronicles her journey to Kenya and Uganda to find the boy who first opened her eyes to the realities of global poverty and the stark failures of the international aid industry. And that led Ms. Hogan to found and direct her own organization called Beyond Good Intentions. It produces films and educational programs about international aid. Her book is published by Seal Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Tori Hogan to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Leonard.
Why did you decide as a teenager to volunteer for Save the Children?
You know, it was this inner calling, kind of a churning of my conscience. I had spent some time volunteering as a researcher in a Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon, and there was something that I just felt deep inside of me, some kind of injustice. Something wasn't right, and I needed to do something about it.
So you interned?
I interned for Save the Children, and I was 20 years old, and I really thought I was going to go save some kids. You know, for the price of a cup of coffee a day, you could save a child. And I was faced with the reality that I wasn't saving any kids. And it was a boy in a refugee camp who brought that to my attention. He stood up one day when I was interviewing this class of students, and he said, "You know, this aid isn't working. And who do you think you are?" Essentially, he called me out and I had to respond. It was my moment of obligation of recognizing maybe I'm not actually doing all that much good.
Well, how had you wound up in Africa and Kenya? They don't send interns there, do they?
I'm a bit persistent. You're right. They don't usually. But there's always ways.
Did you have any illusions about working in international aid before you worked with Save the Children?
I think there was maybe a slight uncertainty about what I was getting myself into, but I wanted to believe that it could work. I think I was a little bit naive at that time, and I wanted to believe that it was as good as I hoped.
Well, we often hear about what life is like in a refugee camp for the refugees, but what is it like for aid workers?
It's a great question. It's a mix, honestly. I mean, it's a hard life. I will never say that aid workers live, you know, high on the hog and, you know, luxury lifestyle. But when you compare it to the refugees that you're living right next door to, it's pretty fancy. You know, I was living in the UN compound, and one of the stories that really always makes my blood boil is that they needed a bigger TV because the World Cup was going to be played. And so they went to great lengths to order this $4,000 big screen TV. And at the same time, the refugees were having their rations cut. And I just couldn't understand that. So, it's a mixed bag in terms of what it's like for the aid workers themselves.
What are the typical rations given to refugees? Do they get any fresh foods?
Unfortunately, no. It's one of the biggest problems. I mean, it really is just mostly dry foods and, not enough by any means. Every refugee you talk to, particularly where I was working in Dadaab refugee camp, will say, "We can't make this last." And so they're really forced to kind of go on and find food on the other marketplaces.
Well, where are the organizations buying these foods? These are mostly canned foods and dried foods?
Yeah, and almost all of it comes from the U.S. A lot of the food donations are sponsored by USAID and the World Food Program, and a lot of those are shipped in on cargo ships all the way from the middle America.
Wouldn't it be more efficient to purchase food and goods locally from nearby nations that may be a bit more stable but that could actually use the trade?
Absolutely. And it's something I advocate for because it would really bolster the local economy as well as give the refugees the food that they would like most to eat.
So did that trip cause you to become disillusioned?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, I became so jaded. It was unbelievable. That boy's comment really changed me. And I came back kind of with mixed emotions. Part of me felt that the best thing I could do for the developing world was stay out of it. And I didn't see a role for myself. I didn't think it was right. But later, I started to understand that because I was able to step back and have this perspective about aid and how it really should be improved, that maybe that indeed was my calling. So I began my organization, Beyond Good Intentions, in 2006. And I traveled around the world for a year interviewing aid organizations in 10 different countries to try to get a better understanding about how we can do this work better. And that turned into a 10-part film series.
I'm curious about certain aspects of refugee camps. Hmm. They're thought of as very temporary, but they wind up being very long-term, don't
Many
they?
Of them are for protracted refugee situations. And that's a tricky situation for the aid agencies, because how do you help when your budget is quote-unquote emergency aid, and you're only allocated money year to year? You can't plan long-term, and it really is ineffective.
And then, since these places are in the middle of nowhere, the people in the camps can't find work often. They're discouraged from finding work because they're in a foreign country.
Exactly. And that is a huge problem. And there's such a sense of idleness and a lack of purpose. I would highly encourage people to look more into what this what the rules of the UN Convention are, because truly they should be allowed to work.
Well, what is the United Nations role in maintaining a typical refugee camp?
Well, if you ask the refugees, they'll say they're just supposed to keep us alive. And so there is this sense that there's kind of just a minimum standard of, we give you food and shelter and, you know, that's it. But when you're in a refugee camp, as they've been in Dadaab since the early 90s, it sometimes needs to go beyond that.
Now, why are they there so long?
Well, things in Somalia haven't improved quite enough yet for them to go home. There even have been new uprisings in the last few years that have brought even more refugees there.
But the UN isn't the only organization working with these people. There are lots of NGOs. Do they collaborate with each other, cooperate with each other?
Well, unfortunately, there's not really an incentive to collaborate and cooperate, because all of the NGOs, particularly the large international NGOs, are going after the same donor money. And therefore, it's a bit of a competitive industry.
Well, you went to Kenya in 2002, then again in 2010. Had mm-hmm. the situation changed much?
It hadn't. No, there were more refugees there. But there were also more aid agencies there. So in 2002, there was what would be called donor fatigue. People were not excited about the Somali refugee crisis anymore. And in 2010, I saw a little bit more interest. But in terms of the quality of life for the refugees, it really hadn't changed.
And you also say that you feel overhead costs are generally too high for aid work. Why? What accounts for those costs? Other than flat-screen television.
Yeah, right. Oh, a lot of the money goes towards, international consultants and travel costs. And there's, taking care of families. And, in the main cities, you might have a very nice apartment in Nairobi or house. You have drivers. You have cooks and cleaners. I mean, there's certain things to maintain the lifestyle of an aid worker that requires a lot of money. I remember when I worked for Save the Children, I was able to look at a lot of the budget documents, and on my $500,000 grant, I would be surprised, I think, if maybe 10% really meant something in the field. So we get attached to evaluating aid organizations based on the percentage of overhead. So you always see them saying, oh, only 10% overhead or 5% overhead. And we think that's the mark of a good organization. But in reality, you need to look more about, what does that 90% really look like that they are spending, quote unquote, in the field? Is that on, expat salaries and workshops that are just repetitive, or is it for real programming?
My guest is Tracy Hogan, who's written a book called Beyond Good Intentions. It's published by Seal Press. Well, so here we have a situation where these various organizations are all competing for the same donors. Mm-hmm. There's an inefficient use spending of the funds that they do get. What's the solution here? Getting some kind of some organization that will then allocate funds and work things out so that everybody works at the most efficient level?
There are a few solutions. I mean, one is that a lot of the problems in aid are caused by the fact that it's very donor-driven. So the people that are making the decisions are usually the people with the money. And that means that there's not a feedback loop for the people that you're helping. It doesn't matter whether or not they like what's being offered. All that matters is that you've pleased your donor. And so that is one of the first things that really needs to change if we're going to see improvements in international aid.
In your book, you focus on the concept of human dignity. Why do you say that international aid organizations often fail to uphold the dignity of the refugees that they're in charge of?
I haven't seen that as a central focus for many organizations. And when I was talking with many of the refugees, they were, again, very sure that the agencies were only there for the bare bones, just to keep them alive. And it wasn't about making sure that they did that in a dignified way. And the way that I saw that most strongly was in the food collection process. It just was like corralling cattle, and it just shocked me.
You mean a truck?
No,
what I've seen is a truck, and then people all clamoring to get a little bag of rice.
Yeah, we've all seen that on TV. That's how it happens in the early days of an emergency situation. But once you're there for a long time, in Dadaab, they have these kind of like long hallways of this wooden structure that you walk through, and you bend down and, you know, put your bag in front of a fence, and some woman ladles in some food, and then you're all crammed together in what I would call like the flower mosh pit, and it's just really undignified.
But they are getting water, food, shelter, and clothing.
Right. So there are critics who would say, well, that's better than what the alternative would be.
Yeah,
at least we're doing something, and that's
because
what I
they'd be outside. They'd be foraging for things on their own.
Exactly. And that is an issue that deserves consideration, because the international community is doing something. But my stance is, you know, maybe that's not enough. You know, doing something is great, but what if it's something that does more harm than good?
Talk a bit about the problem of mission creep among NGOs. How much do organizations allow their priorities to be delegated by the donors that you mentioned earlier?
This is such a problem. Mission creep refers to basically when you start out with one particular goal in mind or one expertise that your organization really is able to focus on. But then the donor says, well, we want to give some money for AIDS, and then we want to give some money for girl child education. And what about, you know, and
so it's
then
almost
all
like fads, even though these are all important issues.
Exactly. But suddenly you're doing, you know, you're the jack of all trades and master of none. You're doing 10 different projects, and you're not good at any of them. And it's a huge problem. A lot of diluting of efforts when that happens.
Are large international aid organizations better at doing these things than the smaller ones?
My stance is no. I think that we're better off focusing on more grassroots initiatives than the middle and large organizations.
And many of these are working with contracts, aren't they?
Yes.
So how do they have a long-term commitment?
Unfortunately, no. That would be great if they did, but there's not long-term outlook for most organizations. Most are on grants of about 2 to 3 years.
Do the local communities have a voice in how development money is spent?
It really depends on the organization, but usually no. Usually that's an afterthought. You know, it's not coming into a community and saying, what do you want? What do you need? But it's participation in the way that, okay, you participate, and then we're going to do what we want to do anyway.
Tori, I have to ask you a different kind of question. Why, in a book that's largely about international aid policies, did you devote so many pages to a troubled relationship you had with a former Dutch boyfriend who you reunited with in Africa?
It's a worthwhile question. I did include my love story, and the reason I did that was, it did happen. This is all a real story of what happened in my trip in 2010. And I think that it brings a degree of vulnerability to me as a storyteller. But also I want this book to be open to people who would never read End of Poverty or White Man's Burden. They aren't interested in the political science and policy side of aid effectiveness, but want a story. And they want to experience this and learn about it from a more personal angle.
You also traveled to Uganda to conduct research for this book. How did your experience there what impact did it have on your opinions about international aid work? Was it different than what you saw in Kenya?
A little bit. I started to see more effective aid, particularly at the grassroots level in Uganda. And
because of the different government there? Or?
No, I mean, you know, in Kenya you can have great aid too. It's just, you know, it depends on where you go and what you see. But I found that in Uganda, when you get far off the beaten path, the aid agencies are less likely to go there. Often aid follows the paved roads. And so once you get really far away, I was on the Congo border in Uganda. They didn't have access to aid. And so they, you know, did it themselves. And it was really impressive to see what was possible when communities came together and found their own solutions.
Well, you are a bit critical of Doctors Without Borders, and they are one of the most admired NGOs in the world.
Actually, in this book, I'm not critical of them. I have a lot of praise for them. I was critical. Back when I saw them in 2002, I really didn't approve of their approach. I felt that it was, well-intentioned doctors coming in for short periods of time and not really integrating with the local community. But what I saw on my return trip really changed my mind.
Do you still believe that aid work can be truly selfless and altruistic?
No, I don't think so.
So if I want to help people in one of these refugee camps, are there organizations I would be best to give money to, or should I just say, well, it's not going to work anyway?
No, I wouldn't go to that. I hope I don't turn people off from giving. I don't think it's that bad. But I do think that you need to be a very conscientious donor, and you have to really do the due diligence that's necessary to find out which organizations are doing good work.
And can people, Europeans and Americans, in these countries ever be anything more than strangers?
I have never gotten to that point. I felt that I lived in Uganda for some time, and I felt that I could live there a decade and still wouldn't be able to make a decision on their behalf or really feel like I was integrated.
All of these, the countries involved, seem to have mixed records. Uganda has a lot of troubles politically, mm-hmm. and it has a civil war going on. Rwanda, which you praise to some degree, has been an obstacle for peace in neighboring Congo, and yet they do good things. So it's not just the outsiders who are causing these problems. It's the governments themselves.
It can be. Rwanda's taken a unique approach in that they have taken control of their own development, and they have said to all of the external donors, saying, this is what we need, this is what we want. Are you in or are you out? And it's very rare to see that.
So have you become totally cynical when it comes to international aid work?
I was, and I think that's part of the reason I wanted to take this trip. And I think I've softened a lot, because what I realized is that we can do good in this world, and it often comes down to the individuals.
And what would you recommend an aspiring aid worker do to prepare for a career in this area?
Practice humility, for sure. Know that you're going to be a drop in the bucket, not the hero of Africa. And do your research before you get into this, because it's not what we think it is.
Tori Hogan will be speaking and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street and Broadway. Her book, Beyond Good Intentions, which is also the name of her organization. The subtitle is A Journey into the Realities of International Aid. It's published by CL Books, which is a division of Perseus. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you so much, Leonard.